All right. Acts chapter 23. Acts the 23rd chapter. And Paul, of course, as we turn over to that particular place, Paul is sort of in a precarious spot, as we have talked about, I believe, in our last class. You remember going back to the beginning of chapter 23 here that Paul was dealing with the council and that it wasn't really going his way. Things kind of unraveled on him, beginning with the high priest ordering him to be struck. And of course, then Paul said some things back that he sort of regretted. Not that what he said, he basically said that the high priest Ananias was a hypocrite. And of course, that was true. There's no doubt about that. But according to Jewish law, you were not to speak in an unfavorable way against those in places of authority. Paul recognized that immediately. And so he told them that he didn't realize that Ananias was the high priest. But again, he could see it was all unraveling. And so he brought up, as you recall, the fact that he believed in the resurrection, which the Pharisees believed in and the Sadducees did not. So that caused a commotion amongst them, and so Lysias had to come to Paul's rescue again before he was afraid that they would tear him apart, and so took him back to the barracks. And at verse 11, we find that Jesus appears to Paul and encourages him. Paul, of this, of course, had to be frustrating to Paul. He really, even here in chapter 23, didn't get very far at all and defending himself. And of course, his defense of himself would have been would have been teaching the gospel. And he always looked forward to that sort of thing. He wanted to tell his kinsmen according to the flesh all about Jesus. But he barely got started before all this began to unravel. And so no doubt he's frustrated. And Jesus realized he needed some encouragement. So verse 11 tells Paul, take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome. And so that had to have been very encouraging. Then in verse 12, we see the plot. I think we closed last week dealing a little bit with this plot that was formulated against Paul, the 40 men or 40 plus men that gathered themselves together and took an oath, determined that they wouldn't eat or drink until Paul was dead. And we were talking a little bit about these, exactly who these individuals were. We really can't be sure completely who they were. It doesn't say in the text who they are. I was emphasizing that there were a group that were referred to as the Zealots, who became, as time went on, very aggressive. And eventually there was a group of people amongst the Jews who became murderous assassins. And there's a connection between them and the Zealots. It's not that this group was simply the Zealots themselves completely. It's not like they morphed into being these assassins. The Sicarii is what they were known as. But a lot of the Zealots, no doubt, had joined that group because they had the same exact philosophy. They were very zealous of Judaism. And they hated the fact that some of the Jews were going along with Roman rule and collaborating with them in a lot of ways. And so they both had that kind of anger. The difference between the Sicarii and the Zealots would have simply been the Zealots, they really hated the Romans, and they would be upset with any Jews who would go along with them and of course, be disgusted by that on a lot of levels. But basically, their hatred was toward the Romans. The Sicarii, who really became the assassins, they hated the collaborators. They hated the Romans, too. Again, they had all this in common, but most of their venom was against those Jews who would go along and compromise and show themselves to be weak Jews, so to speak. And that's who they hated. And they were, as we tried to paint the picture last time, they were a very dangerous group of people. They were just like modern-day terrorists. And the way they would murder people, assassinate people, they would do it mostly with little daggers, which is what the word sicarii basically points to, a dagger. And they would, in a crowd of people, they would walk up to someone who they had pointed out, or they had targeted rather, as someone to be assassinated. It was usually a Jewish person who was affluent, had some influence on people who had compromised. And they would walk up to the person in a crowd, and with one of those daggers would stab them. And they would know exactly where to stab, and somewhere in the back, somewhere that would kill them. But, you know, it wouldn't cause a big commotion. They would basically collapse and bleed out, and it would be a few seconds before anybody would even know anything was happening. And finally, when they see someone laying there and realize this wasn't just someone who fell, but now there's blood all over, they might cause a commotion, but by that time, the assassin would be gone. And so that they did that often. And so you could see how they didn't have the same philosophy as terrorists today. Terrorists today, they do things specifically to cause terror. And that the Sicarii, they weren't much interested in that, but it had the same effect. You know, people would start thinking, you know, always when you're in a crowd and that sort of thing, you'd be worried about exactly, you know, if attack was going to take place, that sort of thing. So the point of it all is, there was this group out there. Now, whether these individuals, these 40 plus men, are associated with that group in Paul's day, they had basically formulated, had become who they were, and so it could have very well been that they had connections with the Sicarii. Again, wouldn't be dogmatic about that, but whoever they were going to kill Paul, and their plot was sound. It was going to work. If it wasn't for the things that transpire that we'll read right now, that there's no question but that it was going to work. Remember, the plot was to tell the chief captain, get Paul to come and have an interview again with the council, because there's the council wants to question him some more. And of course, Lysias would have right away said, okay, he still hasn't gotten any answers yet. So he would say right away, let's do this. Let's go ahead. I'll send him to you. And on his way, they were going to ambush him. And they would have been able to do that. It's not something they had to do in secret. They were just going to ambush him, period. And so whatever, you know, they at this point, it wouldn't matter what would happen to the ones doing the ambushing. They were going to get him. So nothing was going to stop them from doing that. And so, but as we continue to read, you drop down to about verse 16, and we'll begin there. At verse 16, it says, now the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, so he went and he entered the barracks and told Paul. Now, again, that's very interesting to me that here we just don't know a whole lot about Paul's family. You know, there's a lot of things we wish and with regard to Scripture. I've often said I wish we had a little more information about the growing up years of Jesus. And, you know, just certain things, of course, we don't. So there you have it. But you kind of sometimes wish, you know, what was his life like growing? Well, another thing that comes to my mind is Paul and his family. What was his relationship with his family? Most scholars believe that in Philippians 3, when Paul says, I have counted all things but loss for the excellency of Christ, that a part of that loss would have been his family. Paul clearly is from an elite Jewish family. We have seen that as we've gone, particularly in these last several chapters with regard to Paul. He's from an elite family. We don't know anything about his family, but we know that he is a Roman citizen and he was born such. And so his father, at least, maybe even his grandfather, were Roman citizens. We know where Paul got his education. He was educated at the feet of Gamaliel. Not everybody had that opportunity. The elite had that opportunity. That's like going to Harvard or something like that. And so that, you know, he was from that kind of family. Now we find out that he has a sister and his sister's son is here in Jerusalem. Now I just wish we had more facts about that. What does that mean? Does that mean that maybe his sister, sympathizing with him, maybe even a convert. We don't know. Could have been his son was just there being educated like Paul was, or did his sister and nephew live there? You know, what was the situation there? One thing is clear is that his sister's son cares about Paul. And by the way, you know, he has to be somebody himself. I mean, here he is. How in the world did he hear about this plot? I mean, here, you remember, it is these assassins talking with the council. They have to be in some kind of private situation. And his nephew, though, is in a position where he hears it. Is he in the room with them? Is he maybe an assistant to one of the people who, one of the Pharisees on the council? Or, you know, what is, we don't have all those facts. But one thing is clear, he's in close proximity to these people so that he can, so he overheard this plot against Paul. And first thing he does is he goes to Paul and he begins to tell them exactly what he has heard. There were more than 40 who made this conspiracy, and it's back at verse 12. Drop down, Elizabeth, I'm sorry, down at verse 17 again. Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take this young man to the tribune, for he has something to tell them." And so he took him and he brought him to the tribune and said, "Paul, the prisoner called me and asked me to bring this young man to you as he has something to say to you." The tribune took him in by the hand and going aside asked him privately, "What is it that you have to tell me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow as though they were going to inquire somewhat more closely about him. But do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him, who have bound themselves by an oath neither to eat or drink until they have killed him. And now they are ready, waiting for your consent." And so the tribune dismissed the young man, charging him, "Tell no one that you have informed me of these things." And so he does exactly what Paul wants him to do. Now, Lysias has some decisions to make here, doesn't he? You stop and think about it. Now, all of a sudden he hears about this plot. What should he do? He basically has three things that he can do. He can, number one, just ignore it and just let Paul get ambushed and killed. And then this whole thing kind of goes away. But if he does that, then that's going to, of course, be a negative thing with regard to him and his reputation. He's the one in charge of all of this. For that to happen under his watch wouldn't be a great thing. And somebody would have to pay the price for that. It wouldn't be him. It would be maybe one of the ones that were watching over Paul. Somebody would lose their life if Paul got killed. He could have just said, "Well, you know, so be it. That's just collateral damage. But my problems will go away if I just let Paul get ambushed and die." And the second one would be to just say no. You know, the plot is, well, these Jews are going to come to you and they're going to inquire about sending Paul to the count. He can say, "No, I'm not going to do that." But then the Jews would be mad at him. And as we have seen all through the book of Acts, the Jews, the Romans didn't want to make the Jews mad. That's always kind of a fascinating thing. The Jews basically, the Romans could crush the Jews anytime they wanted to, really. And, of course, that ends up taking place just a few years from now when the Jewish nation falls. But they were like a bunch of gnats flying around. I mean, the Romans knew that they could cause trouble. And it would be, they could crush them, it would be more trouble than they really wanted to go through. And so they constantly were trying to appease the Jews. And so here's Lysias. He could have just said no to the Jews. "I'm not going to do that." He didn't have, he's the one in charge. He wouldn't have to tell them why he's not. He could just say no. But again, that would be problematic with the Jews. Now the Jews would cause trouble for him, and that could cause trouble with his authorities, and it would look like he doesn't have control of the Jews, and that's the last thing that the emperor wanted and things, so he could lose his post and on. And so, but he did have that option. If he wanted to, he could have just told them no. Or Neither one of those situations sounds real good, does it? The third option is he could get Paul out of town before those Jews come to him and even reveal their plot. Let's just get Paul out of here. I know they're coming and they're going to ask this favor of me, and they're gonna, but if Paul's gone before they even come and ask, then he doesn't, the problem really from his standpoint disappears. And that's what he decides to do. And so as we continue to read down here, then at verse 23, it says, and then he called two of the centurions and he said, get ready 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen to go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night. So he's getting Paul out of there. And also provide mounts for Paul to ride and to bring them safely to Felix, the governor. That is, Felix is the governor of Judea. And he wrote a letter to this effect. And so we find then that he sends Paul away. Now, he's not taking any chances, is he? This is one man. He's trying to get out of town. How many people did he have to guard Paul? 470 men. Can you just visualize that situation? 470 men marching Paul out of town. And so, but he didn't want to take any chances at all. So he was making sure that Paul was going to make it to Felix safely. And that's what he does. And he does so with a letter that was typical at that time. Wrote a letter to give to Felix. Verse 26 says, Claudius Lysias to His Excellency, the Governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them when I came upon them with the soldiers and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen. You see anything wrong with that? What's Lysias doing? He wants to put himself in the most favorable light. We went over this. Is that what happened, really? That Lysias is looking down and all of a sudden he sees a Roman citizen under attack, and so he rescues this Roman citizen. Is that what happened? That's not what happened at all, is it? But, you know, he lied a little bit. You know, he's just trying to get, again, he wants to look good in this situation. He didn't find out that Paul was a Roman citizen until after the fact. But that's not how he words it in this letter to Felix. He says at verse 26, and desiring to know the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. And I found that he was being accused about questions of their law, but charged with nothing deserving death or imprisonment. And so one thing, he does realize now that this whole mess really isn't a Roman situation. This doesn't have anything to do with the violation of Roman law. This is a squabble between Jews. And that's usually what the Romans had to deal with. But that he recognizes that's what this is. And that Paul really hasn't done anything worthy of death. And when it was disclosed to me that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him. So the soldiers, according to their instructions, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. And on the next day, they returned to the barracks, letting the horsemen go on with him. And so they sent some of these 470 back. And when they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they presented Paul also before him. On reading the letter, he asked what province he was from, and when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive. And he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's praetorium. And so now here's Paul in a different situation. He's gotten out of this danger of this plot, but now he's going to be standing before Felix. And that brings us to chapter 24 then. Any questions about chapter 23? Yes. Yeah.
In all of this, God intervened throughout. He said back in verse 11, you're going to Rome.
Yes.
So right there says, Paul's not going to die no matter what they do.
Yes.
And so I believe God intervened.
Yeah.
Through this whole situation.
Yeah.
He may have even worked in the mind of the commander, you know, to make sure that everything was the way it ought to be to protect.
Yes.
So I believe this, I think this whole account is God's intervention.
Here. Yeah, and that brings up a wonderful point. And we didn't stop to talk about it, but we surely could. If we wanted to, we could spend the whole class dealing with the providence of God, couldn't we? That, you know, when you read this story, and Paul's nephew happened to have been there when this plot was being formulated, and he happened to hear it and was able to get to Paul and warn him, and if it, again, Paul would have been dead. There's no question that if his nephew wasn't there and heard that plot, they would have executed Paul. Unless God decided to intervene providentially in some other way. But the point of it is, apart from the providence of God, Paul would have been dead. And I think sometimes we think, no, he wouldn't. He's Paul. Oh, no, that couldn't have Peter. That's Peter. No, these are just men. There's not any one man, whoever it is, or group of men, who could be executed or die or whatever, and all of a sudden the cause of Christ just disappears. I mean, the church would have went on without Paul, would have gone on without Paul. And so, I mean, there's no question in my mind whatsoever, but that if his nephew wasn't here, happened to have been at the right place at the right time, that Paul would have died. They would have executed Paul. And I'm with Dale on this. There's no question in my mind, but that this was the working of God's providence. And the providence of God is probably the hardest subject in all the Bible. And understanding exactly when something happens by chance and when something happens by the providence of God, sometimes it is very evident, like with the story of Joseph, probably the greatest story of providence in the Bible. There's no question, but that was providential, everything that happened to Joseph. Or is it something that happens by chance? A lot of things happen in life by chance. The Bible teaches that. So it's a very difficult subject. But again, I'm with Dale. I think it's very little doubt in my mind, but this was the providence of God sparing Paul on this occasion. Yeah, Dale. Surely. Yes. Yes.
Pass it on, you know.
Yes.
I'm not going to deal with this issue. I might get burnt. I'm passing it on.
Yes. Yeah, that's, I mean, they did the same thing with Jesus, you know, and politicians. What can you say? At the end of the day, these are all politicians. And you think politicians ever do anything like that today? Because they're all very, very honest. You think a politician would ever put himself in a favorable light and change the facts a little bit? Never. These are politicians, really. And so that's exactly right, Dave. Yeah, I mean, he thinks that he has gotten rid of this situation, and he has, really. And so now it's up to Felix to deal with this situation here. All right. No other comments or questions about chapter 23? Remember, the chapter breaks are there by man. So we just roll right into chapter 24, and it says, "And after 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some of the elders and a spokesman, one Tertullus, and they laid before the governor their case against Paul." Now, this is very interesting. The Jews hired this spokesman. You could tell by his name, Tertullus, that he is not a Jew. So he is probably a Roman, a Greek, a Roman, and he's an attorney, is what he is. He is, I think the King James says, orator. The Greek word basically means an advocate, and which is what he is. And so he's an attorney. So they hire there were a group of attorneys sometimes that would hire themselves out just to defend cases that they had absolutely no interest in at all, and they would speak as if they were a part of it. And you can tell as he begins to deliver his case against Paul that he speaks as if he's one of them. He's not one of them at all. He's just a hired spokesman, an orator, to set forth their case. Why in the world would the Jews do that except for they've been failing miserably at trying to get Paul, executed and get him in trouble. So now they bring someone in. They bring in a big gun to let this professional attorney, this lawyer who speaks for a living. Let's set forth the case. Let him set forth the case. So that's what he does. And as he begins this thing, he does what they all these attorneys, all these orators, they would always do it whenever they were setting forth a case. They would begin with flattery. As they were, whoever they were addressing, whoever was in charge, they would flatter the person. And so it goes on to say then, since through the years, or since through you rather, I'm sorry, we enjoy much peace. And since by your foresight, most excellent Felix, reforms are being made for this nation. In every way and in everywhere, we accept this with all gratitude. Sound like fun? Sound like flattery to you? Most excellent Felix. He didn't deserve. Listen, Felix was terrible. He was a violent individual. In fact, before this, he had Jonathan, the high priest before Ananias, executed just because Jonathan suggested to him that he behave a little better in a way that was more fitting as the governor of Judea. He said, what? Had him killed. And that's just how bad he was. Now, one thing he did do, there was some peace in his jurisdiction and all of that. And so that part of this is true enough that when he says we enjoy much peace since by your foresight, most excellent Felix, reforms are being made for this nation. There was some truth to that. But he's really poured it on. In every way and everywhere, we accept this with all gratitude. I'm trying to find it. I think it's here in the King James. Those of you who have the King James or maybe even the New King James, it says where it says foresight here. And since by your foresight, I believe that's the place. Is that the place where the word providence is used in the King James or New King James? All right. Yeah.
That,
does it? Yes. Oh, it does. Okay, good, good. See, now listen, I'm reading from ESV, so this wouldn't be true, but it's like someone told me before when I used to use the King James Version. Boy, if you go to the New American Standard, you could save us a lot of time because every time you explain a word, my version says it. Well, ESV does a pretty good job at that, but doesn't use the word attorney. But anyway, the word providence, again, providence. We're referring to the providence of God. That word usually is reserved for God. Let me put it like this. It denotes divine work, usually. Almost always when that word is used. It denotes divine work. Among the Romans, sometimes they would use that with regard to the emperor. And talk about the providence of the emperor.
So,
yeah, to them, that's exactly right. And that's why they would do that. He was divine. And so they would do. And so, but to call a governor, to use that terminology for a mere governor, that was a little over the top, wasn't it? What is this guy doing?
Buttering him up.
That's all. That's all he's doing. Robert, yes. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you had... Okay, I thought you raised your hand. But that's all he's doing here. He's just buttering them up. And that's typical. You know, I mean, he's a good spokesman. He's an orator. He knows exactly what he's doing. He's about to lay out the case. But it all, of course, is going to be decided by Felix. And so he's really buttering him up, giving him all kinds of flattery here. Well, now he's going to set the case. Verse 4, he says, but to detain you no further, I beg you in your kindness to hear us briefly. For we have found this man a plague. Now he's just being insulting, isn't he? So he's buttered up Felix. Now the one who they want him to bring a charge against, he starts name calling. He's a plague. He's a disease to us. Is what it is. And that's just a general statement about the character of this man, Paul. We know it wasn't true, but that was just, he was just trying to paint a picture of what a troublemaker this man was. But then after he calls him a plague, he sets forth three specific charges with regard. He says, one who stirs up riots among all the Jews throughout the world. That's charge number one. Now, you know, there might be some circumstantial evidence that would be in his favor about that. What happens everywhere Paul goes? we've read it in the book of Acts. In Antioch, you remember of Pisidia, there was a great commotion. And where was Paul? Right in the middle of it. And then at Ephesus, there was a great mob and another riot took place. And where was Paul? He wasn't right there, but they were there. Of course, the mob formulated because of Paul. And so then here again in Jerusalem, another mob formulated. And so, you know, one might say, well, maybe there's some truth to that, but it was all surface stuff. Because when you begin to look at each one of those cases, there was trouble in Thessalonica, in Berea, other places where Paul had been, trouble. But when you look at each case, Paul wasn't at fault in any of them. He wasn't trying to stir up a riot or anything like that. It was usually the unbelieving Jews. In Ephesus, it was the Gentiles, of course. But it never was it Paul's fault. He was never, in other words, being a troublemaker. So that was just kind of a surface argument. But that's what he's charging Paul with. This man is a troublemaker. He's a causer of riots. And throughout the world, that is the Roman Empire, we have seen this happen with Paul. And so he's making his case. Yes. Yes.
But it seems as though this goes way back. They remember who Paul was originally. He was a devout Jew.
Yeah.
Well respected among the Jewish nation. And he's changed. He's made this change. And it seems as though they really remember all this.
Yeah. Yeah.
No matter where he went. You know, the Jews just, they were out to get him regardless. It didn't matter where he was at. Who he was in a crowd or by himself.
Yes.
It didn't matter. It seems like it just goes back a long ways. And they're remembering from the beginning.
Yeah.
The change in Paul's life.
No doubt about it.
And they just can't.
They hate Paul. And you remember, we know from our study in Romans that they also, Paul is what? He's an apostle to who? To the Gentiles. And we know the Jews hate the Gentiles. So there's no doubt that the Jews, the Sanhedrin, all of the leading, who would remember Paul, of course, they had a special thing against Paul. They thought he was a Gentile lover. His doctrine was leaving most of the Jews in an unsaved condition and all of that. So there's no doubt the hostility of the Jews towards Paul, that all of that plays a part in the whole thing. But right now they've turned the offensive over to another Gentile because they know he can do a better job and he's doing pretty good. You know, Paul's a troublemaker. He's caused riots. Just you look everywhere he goes, there's a riot. There's some kind of trouble taking place. And so that's what he's charging him with. Not only that, he says, and is a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. And so he's actually what they're doing. He's not only attacking Paul, but first of all, he's putting Christianity as a whole in an unfavorable light. It's just a sect. And he's hinting at the fact that this is an unauthorized religion, is what it is. The Romans didn't care about other religions. They all had their gods and that sort of thing. But you had to, it had to be authorized. It had to be okayed by them. And he's sort of hinting at, you know, this sect of the Nazarenes, it's something that is out there. It hasn't even been authorized. And Paul is the chief. He's the ringleader of this group. And Paul, of course, is going to answer all of these things, but he's setting up charges against him. And then not only is he the ringleader and all of this, but the final thing he says, he even tried to profane the temple but we seized him. So that's the third accusation. So the three things. He first of all says, now, remember, this man is just a plague. He's just a disease. Causing trouble wherever he goes. He's caused riots. He's a ringleader of this new sect over here. And he even tried to profane the temple. Everybody knows how sacred and holy the temple is. He tried to profane it. Now, that's kind of interesting, just the wording here. Because what was Paul really accused of with regard to the temple? Which he didn't do, but the charge was he did. So the original charge was that he didn't try to profane the temple. He did profane the temple. He had Gentile. He brought a Gentile in there. That was what got this whole thing started. Now all of a sudden in this offensive here by this lawyer, he's speaking for them. He says he tried to do it. Well, did he do it or didn't he do it? Did he take a Gentile in there or not? But he didn't want us to get bogged down with the facts of any of that. Just he tried to profane the temple. And so that's the charge that is laid out then against Paul. By examining him yourself, you will be able to find out from him about everything of which we accuse him. The Jews also joined in the charge, affirming that all of these things were so. Well, of course they agreed. Who do you think told this lawyer all these things? He's speaking for them. And now they're in the background. Yeah. That's all true. And so, yes, Nancy. Yes. Yes, yes. Yes, it is. I mean, they've shown, of course, the Jews are constantly showing hypocrisy. I didn't even catch the first bell. Did you all catch that first bell? I'm sorry about that. Here they are waiting. So we'll pick up there. Paul now will give his defense. He'll answer all these accusations. We'll get to that next week. Appreciate your attention.